strange force has entered the galaxy. The future of mankind is at stake. It could only mean one thing.
Greetings, Captain.
Spock!
I do not think you realize the gravity of your situation.
The vacation is over. Now, the crew of the Starship Enterprise...
Enterprise, are you ready?
...is taking adventure where it has never gone before.
What are you standing around for? Do you not know a jailbreak when you see one?
From the mind of a madman...
Hostile force has taken control of our vessel.
Mr. Solo, full ahead.
...through the center of the galaxy...
You know we'll never make it through the Great Barrier.
...to the final frontier...
Fascinating.
How often have you done this?
Actually, it's my first attempt.
Fire the rockets!
You never cease to amaze me.
Nor I myself.
This is the boldest trek of all.
Warp speed now.
Star Trek V, the final frontier.
Mr. Scott, you're amazing.
There's nothing amazing about it. I know this ship like the back of my hand.
Writer and film historian Ray Morton has joined us again, and we're going to discuss the production and the fallout, as it were, I guess, from Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. We're going to be celebrating the 35th anniversary of Star Trek V. And I know probably a lot of you listening are wondering, well, the last time you guys talked, you talked about Star Trek III. Why are you jumping ahead to Star Trek V? Well, that's because... Star Trek III is celebrating its 40th, and Star Trek V is celebrating its 35th, as it were. So I figured when we get to the year, I guess 2026, we can do Star Trek IV and Star Trek VI.
Ah, yes. We'll do two for one.
We'll do that. So, and I'm planning on keeping this going, assuming people want me to. I don't know. But anyway, we're here to talk about Star Trek V as it was. And it's a very interesting story, I think, behind it. Now, I had not seen... Well, first of all, we'll talk about your work. If anybody's listening for the first time, Ray has written some really great books about such varied cinematic subjects as Close Encounters of the Third Kind, A Hard Day's Night, King Kong, of course. His King Kong book is what I would consider... the Bible, by which all others should be measured, all of the Kong books should be measured. So if you aren't familiar with his books, I would say go to those places where you can find books and type in his name and look. And I'm sure if you love movies, you will find something that you love there. So anyway, now we can get back to the subject of Star Trek V. So Star Trek V, I must admit that this is the one Star Trek film I had never seen because the reviews were just so bad, and I'd seen all of the others, and I said, okay, I'm going to pull the trigger because we're doing this interview, and I had it on 4K, and so I put it on last night, and I was totally surprised. I didn't think it wasn't as bad as I had expected. Now, is it a great film? No, but it wasn't the train wreck. I'll be honest, I thought it was much better than just about any of the three J.J. Abrams Star Trek films. So I'll come clean and say that. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of people who will disagree with me on that, but for all of its flaws, I still think it was better than that trio of films. So... but anyway, I'm getting way ahead of myself. So I guess we can talk about the production of the film, what led, you know, of course, I think, you know, William Shatner was a little bit jealous of the fact that Nimoy got a chance to direct, and so he wanted his chance, and so, but I'll let you tell us what really happened with the development of Star Trek V.
Sounds good. Well, to get really in the weeds, the development of Star Trek V actually started in the 60s during the making of the original series. And by that, I mean that at some point, you know, there was sort of, you know, William Shatner was the star of Star Trek and Leonard Nimoy was obviously the key supporting actor. But of course, the character of Mr. Spock became enormously popular and essentially became the co-lead of the show. and there was some frustrations between both actors at that time. And one of the fallouts of those frustrations was that they ended up negotiating what's called a favored nations clause in their contracts, which meant that anything Shatner got, Nimoy would get, and anything Nimoy got, Shatner would get. And that contract, that basic parameter, lasted for the remainder of the series. And then when they started to make movies 10 years later, though, that concept held. All of their movie contracts were favored nations. And so famously, Leonard Nimoy, after Star Trek II, wanted to direct. And he leveraged the fact that they wanted him to be in Star Trek III, and worked out a deal where he could direct that film. And so once that happened, that meant that at some point in the future, William Shatner was going to have the opportunity to direct a film. And he originally wanted to direct Star Trek IV because he wanted to come right on the heels of Leonard. If Leonard got it, he wanted it. But Paramount was so happy with the reception of Star Trek III, both critically and at the box office, that they did not want to mess with a winning formula. So they wanted producer Harve Bennett and Leonard Nimoy to come back and do the next film. And Shatner kicked up a bit of a fuss. Star Trek II and Star Trek III both came out in the summers of their respective years. Star Trek IV came out. There was a two-year gap, 82, then 84. Star Trek IV came out at Christmas of 86. And the reason it came out so many months later rather than the summer is Shatner was holding out for contract negotiations. And basically, if he was going to not direct Star Trek IV, he wanted more money. And, you know, there was a whole lot of back and forth. But finally, they got Star Trek IV underway. And Star Trek IV came out and was obviously a huge hit. It was not the highest grossing of the Star Trek films. That was still the first picture, but it was the first one in a while that had broken well over $100 million, and it was very popular and critically very well received. And basically, it was just a gigantic success all around. And one of the other key points of that is Leonard Nimoy and the producer Harve Bennett, they had worked up the story for Star Trek IV, and Leonard Nimoy gets a credit as story by, along with Harve Bennett, and that's important because once he wrote the story, that entitled Shatner to write the story of whatever film he was going to direct. So all of these rights kept accruing. So by the time they got to the end of Star Trek IV, Shatner had the contractual right to direct and write the next movie, or at least conceive the story for the next movie. And at that point, Leonard Nimoy said, I want to direct another one, Paramount would have supported that and found a way to push off Shatner doing it for another film. Probably would have cost a lot more money. But at that point, I think Nimoy both wanted to do something other than Star Trek. And he went on and did Three Men and a Baby, which was another huge hit. And I think he also politically knew that if he caused Shatner to delay any further, it would probably create lots of behind-the-scenes problems. So I think he made a political move and a career move not to direct Star Trek V. So Shatner contractually was now put in control of the movie. And that was, you know, a little tricky, because they really couldn't turn down any story ideas he had. And that leads us to the next piece of the Star Trek V puzzle, which is Shatner came up with the story that he wanted to do. And the genesis of that is really kind of interesting, because he has said that he got the idea at the time Star Trek IV came out in 86. So all through like 87, you know, the year 1987 and all, was when the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker scandals happened. And yeah. Shatner has talked about watching them on television and being kind of impressed in sort of a horrified way that these kind of two obviously kind of phony people had managed to con so many people into giving them money. And he sort of found the idea a little absurd that these guys were the ones that said God was speaking through them. So he he was interested in that. And he basically came up with the core idea of the movie, which is that there would be a villain who would be searching for God and would hijack the Enterprise in order to go looking for God. The reason I find that interesting is Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were clearly sort of villainous people. You know, they were con people and corrupt. And somehow Shatner took that and turned it around to that the person in the movie, the character in the film, was sort of sincere and correct, which I thought was like an interesting interpretation of what had inspired him. But anyway, he came up with this idea that the Enterprise would be hijacked by a villain searching for God, and his idea was they would find God at the end of the movie, and it would turn out to be the devil. And, you know, so they would never actually meet God, but they would meet Satan, and then Satan would attack them, and defeat Satan, I guess, is really what the movie was going to be. And the other piece of it that he wanted was he wanted the story to also to have Spock, Kirk, and McCoy, so sort of the three main characters who had always been friends and you know, compatriots in all of their adventures, to have a big falling out. And I don't remember all of the specifics, but basically some of them were going to believe in this guy searching for God, and Kirk would not, and they would have a fight, and they'd have a falling out. And he really wanted that to be part of the story too. So anyway, that's what he came up with, and he pitched it to Paramount, and his report was that Paramount was enthusiastic about it. I suspect they were not quite as enthusiastic as he reports, only because I think they knew they had to keep him happy. But it's a problematic story, and they brought in producer Harve Bennett, who actually had decided not to produce Star Trek V. And we can get into this when we talk about Star Trek IV, but that was because he and Leonard Nimoy had actually had a huge falling out during the making of Star Trek IV, and Bennett wasn't really sure he wanted to do another Star Trek. And so, but Shatner wanted him because obviously Bennett had been the producer on 2, 3, and 4 and really knew how to make the engine run. So he went to Bennett and he persuaded him to sign on as the producer. And then they started to work on the story. And why I'm saying all this is Bennett's complaint about the story. He said, whatever else was good or bad about it, he felt like it was a non-starter as a story, because if you're doing a movie where you say, we're going to go meet God or we're going to go meet Satan, everybody knows you can't do that, because in the end, no movie is going to be able to say, this is God, because obviously there are so many different ideas about God and what that would be. So he said, basically, whatever ending you come up with is going to be a letdown, no matter what. But Shatner didn't feel that would be the case. So they continued on, but Bennett did have an idea that became a little controversial later. But as the studio started to get into preparations for the film and as they started to develop the script, it did start to occur to people that you can't really make a movie where you say, this is God and this is the devil. Because whatever you do, no matter how you do it, you're going to tick off huge swaths of the audience, right? So Bennett's idea, which I think was quite good, was to say, let's have them go to meet God. And then you find out it's not actually God. It's this evil alien pretending to be God. And then that way you can sort of address all of the issues about God, but you don't ultimately end up claiming that your movie is depicting God in any way. And therefore, hopefully you don't piss people off, basically. And Shatner has since said that he felt accepting that change weakened his story, and that he wished he had stuck with his original idea. I actually think he's wrong. I think Bennett's idea is the only way you could make that story work in a plausible way. So I think that was a good change. But anyway, they brought in a writer named David Lowery, because they tried to get Nick Meyer, but he wasn't interested. And they brought in David Lowery. And David Lowery was a writer who had done at that time it was a spec script. They did later make it, but it was a script called Flashback, and it was about sort of a straight-laced FBI guy. This was the era of the mismatched buddy cop kind of movies. So this was a script about a straight-laced FBI guy who arrests like an old hippie on the run, and the two of them kind of have an adventure as he's trying to bring the guy in. And that was a script called Flashback. They eventually made it with Kiefer Sutherland and Dennis Hopper. I do not think it had been made or in production when they brought on David Lowery, but he had done a film that was a modest hit in the mid-80s called Dreamscape, which apparently he didn't care for. I guess he didn't like the way it got executed. But that was, again, another kind of modest hit. Wasn't a huge one, but it made some money. So David Lowery, he had a contract to Paramount, and Shatner and Harve Bennett interviewed him, and they decided that they would want to work with him on the script. So the three of them continued to work on the story, and then Lowery was going to eventually write the screenplay. And the other piece that comes into the story at that point is the character who in the final film's name is Cybok originally was a character named Czar, and he was kind of a fanatic, like a fanatical religious, you know, Ayatollah kind of guy. And as they were working on this, they realized he was a little too intense and villainous. There was like no way you could get the audience on his side. And also they felt he was too much like the character of Khan in Star Trek II. So they didn't want to repeat themselves. So they kind of came up with this idea to make him more of a tortured soul kind of character, like a very conflicted guy who's trying to find God to satisfy his own internal tensions. And somewhere along the line, that idea became that they were going to make him a Vulcan. And it was an interesting concept, because the idea was this was a passionate Vulcan with emotions, whereas obviously all the Vulcans we knew before that had restrained their emotions. And originally he was just a Vulcan, but they came to a story problem where there was a point where Spock really realistically should have just arrested or killed him. And then they couldn't have him do that for the story. So they needed a reason why Spock would not kill this character. And they came up with the idea that he was Spock's half brother. That I don't think was such a good idea. And I think, I know for a fact Leonard Nimoy hated that idea. And if you notice in many iterations of Star Trek since, nobody has ever mentioned Cybok again. Well, actually, I think in one of the new shows they do mention him. That was the last sort of key piece of it. And then the final chunk of it all is that Star Trek IV had lots and lots of comedy in it. The Star Trek movies are science fiction adventures. They are not comedies, but because Star Trek IV was a time travel story and it was all of the characters like in modern day for that time, lots of fish out of water humor. And also one of the great joys of Star Trek IV is there's lots of very good character humor in it that come out of the characters as we know them. So as they moved into Star Trek V, the studio felt that the comedy was one of the reasons Star Trek IV had become such a big hit. It had grossed literally $40 million more than the previous two films. And they felt the comedy was a huge piece of that. So they really wanted there to be comedy in this new film. And the problem was the premise and the story are not comic stories. Going back in time to save whales is a funny story idea. Meeting a religious fanatical guy who wants to meet God is not comic. So they were working all this humor into the story that was really sort of inappropriate for the story, and kind of it felt grafted on. But that was a mandate from the studio, was to lighten it up as much as possible. Anyway, that's my long-winded way of saying how they got to the development of Star Trek V.
Yeah, that is a very interesting story, and it explains a little bit why why it ultimately failed, because yeah. there were there were some critical decisions made at various junctures there as you're telling that story that certainly sent it in the direction it ultimately went. Yeah, it's the humor is, you know, I do enjoy, or I did enjoy, a lot of the character moments, but there was a little bit too much emphasis on the comedy. You're right about that, and so that's looking at the film from a critical perspective, that does tend to but it is, you know, it's you know, I do enjoy the campfire wraparound, as it were, with the row, row, row your yeah. boat and all. It is a good way to finish the film out. I'll give them that. So, yeah, anybody that's seen it knows what I'm talking about. But, yeah, I guess we could get into the production of the film. Now, something that I noticed, and maybe you'll be able to speak to this, is I think the visual effects in this film were probably the worst of any of the original series yes. of films. And there's probably a good explanation why, which you'll tell us. But I was really – that I wasn't prepared for. I there were certain yeah. scenes I thought, this really doesn't look good at all.
Star Trek V has some good points. But it also has some very significant flaws that I think ultimately kind of torpedoed it. And mm-hmm. as you're saying, one of them was the visual effects. And there have been two Star Trek movies with sort of horrifying visual effects stories. And we did cover, when we talked about the first film, they had hired a company to do the visual effects for Star Trek the Motion Picture, spent a lot of money, and they ended up with... The company did a lot of research and development on technique and machines and didn't produce any visual effects. And so what happened is, one of the reasons Star Trek the Motion Picture cost so much money is at the last minute, they basically hired two new special effects companies and paid them overtime to get the effects ready for the film. They had something like 6 months to get the effects ready, which, you know, is a ridiculously short amount of time, especially in those days. But they had everybody on overtime, and the budget went through the roof because of that. I mean, that was one of the reasons it went through the roof. So when it came time to do, and so Star Trek 2 and 3 and 4, the visual effects were done by Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's company, which had, you know, done the effects for the Star Wars movies, and then in the early 80s had started doing visual effects for outside movies as well. And they had worked very well together on the other three Star Trek films. But what had happened was, the way the business was evolving is that Industrial Light and Magic was the Cadillac of visual effects companies back then. They were the company you wanted to get in order to do your effects if you weren't like doing them yourself, basically. And what ILM started to do was, they started to request a co-production credit on their movies. And actually, if you look at the end of Star Trek IV, there is a credit that says co-produced by Industrial Light and Magic. And basically what that meant was, they had a share of the box office receipts, which was not something that any visual effects company had ever had before. It was all work for hire. And once the work was done and the bills were paid, that was it. With the ILM, they started requesting, because they knew they were part of the attraction, they wanted a piece of the pie, basically. And Paramount did not want to give them a piece of the pie. They kind of, Star Trek IV was a big hit, and Paramount kind of resented that they were giving ILM this percentages. The other problem that they ran into, which Ralph Winter was the executive producer of those films, and he was the guy in charge of effects, and he has talked about this. Basically, when if you pay for visual effects, at least in those days, by the shot. So the company charges X amount for a shot. And if they make any mistakes, or if it doesn't match what was planned, the visual effects company would redo those shots for free. But if the company requested changes, then they would charge additional money. And there was some kind of conflict with ILM over redoing some of the shots for Star Trek IV, where I think they wanted to be paid for it, and I think Ralph Winter felt that they shouldn't be paid for it. So there had been some conflict. So when it came time to do Star Trek V, they started to think about, is there another company that we could go to that would do it for, that would be less expensive to begin with, that wouldn't want a percentage, and that where we'd have maybe a more negotiable, you know, fee on redoing shots and things like that. And at the other time, the other big companies at that time were John Dykstra's company, Apogee, and the company that Richard Edlund was running called Boss Films, which was the current incarnation of the facility that Douglas Trumbull had started back on Star Trek the Motion Picture. But they were all, you know, high-priced companies. And the Star Trek movies were always made for budget, because as popular even as Star Trek IV was, Star Trek was a property that really only appealed mostly to American audiences, because the show was not as well known in Europe and across the world. So there was always sort of a limit on how much money they thought they could make on those films. Even with Star Trek IV being such a big hit, they really make gross somewhere in the $80 to $90 million range. So the thing is, they couldn't spend the money that they would spend like on a Star Wars movie or something, because the grosses were basically limited. So anyway, a long-winded way of saying they wanted to find somebody basically cheaper. They ended up finding a guy named Bran Faron. And Bran Faron had made his name. He had done effects in New York on stage. There was a famous production of Frankenstein in the late 70s that basically ran for one night. And it closed after its opening night. And the production itself had gotten terrible reviews. But Bran Faron had done the effects on stage, and those got spectacular reviews. And that kind of launched his career. And he was also known, his company is the one that did the effects for Altered States, the whole end sequence where William Hurt is pounding against the wall and turning into all sorts of different creatures before he, you know, becomes human again. So they had a good reputation, and they were the only visual effects company that was based in New York. They actually, the company, I think, was in New York City, but their model shops and stages were in Hoboken, and I think they had stages out in the Hamptons as well. So they were the only sort of New York effects company. And I guess Ralph Winter had been impressed by some of their samples. And so they made a deal his company's name was Associates and Faron, and they made a deal with them to do the effects for Star Trek V. And what happened was, they had Associates and Faron had never done a project of this size before. Their work on Altered States was basically only a few shots, and I believe they might have worked on the Manhattan Project, and there were a couple other like smaller New York-based effects films, but they had never done a full, complete effects show like Star Trek V was going to be. And what happened was, they did not have the pipeline. And with visual effects, you need model shops, you need shooting stages, then you need optical. And with optical, in those days, all of the shots were composited optically. And you need a workflow that can accommodate that kind of thing on an assembly line basis. And that is something ILM had perfected, and Apogee had perfected, and Boss Film had perfected. Those guys all knew that. Bran Faron's company basically was learning as they went, and they essentially ran out of time. They didn't schedule it properly. They didn't have enough time to finish the shots. So basically what you end up seeing in the film are their roughs. Like that's what you saw in the film is kind of what a lot of visual effects shots look like before they're finished. And the reason they look so bad is they were never finished. He had also gotten hung up on this idea that he had wanted to not do so many optical effects, Bran Faron. He wanted to do a lot of live on the set effects. They called it the God effect when God appears at the end of the film. That was basically a giant light that they were projecting on stage. And the idea was they wanted to do front projection on a lot of the effects so they could film everything basically in camera so there wouldn't be a lot to be done in post-production. The problem is none of their equipment really worked. So front projection was a thing they've been trying to perfect in movies for a long time, and they just never really got it where they wanted it to be. And so basically they planned a lot of this to be done on the set when they were filming. It didn't work. And then so they had to do it all in post. And basically, again, they just didn't have the schedule and they didn't have the workflow set up. And they were also, they were shooting in Hoboken, New Jersey, and the Optical House was a place called the Optical House in New York City, which was really known for doing commercials. They were not geared for a feature film. So basically everything got backed up. They spent all their budget. The shots weren't finished. And at a certain point, they had to be delivered to Paramount to be put into the film. Unlike Star Trek The Motion Picture, when Paramount saw the quality of the effects, they were not willing to spend more money to fix them. Because, they're, again, for what I said earlier, they felt that the Star Trek movies had to be made on a very tight budget, and that they couldn't really go over because it just wasn't going to play majorly outside of the United States. So they were not willing to redo the effects as they had been on Star Trek The Motion Picture. And so the studio made the decision that the film would go out with effects that looked like that. And it was a disaster, pretty much.
Yeah, that essentially what I was reading is that when they did the test screening, or they screened the rough cut rather, minus the effects, after the principal photography was done, Shatner had said in an interview that that the film received praise, and he left the screening reveling in its reception. That's the quote. He said it turned out to be a momentary victory, quote unquote, once he saw the special effects.
Yes, yeah. I believe he referred to them as my not so special effects. But I think that's right. I actually was at one of the screenings. I'm not sure I would have said ecstatic response, but a little better than probably when they finally saw the effects. Mm. I remember seeing the film its opening day, and I actually thought to myself, I can't believe a major motion picture company let a film go out looking like this. But
wasn't prepared for it when I guess somehow that I had just missed that. I know the reviews were not good, but yeah. The criticism of the special effects, I wasn't quite prepared for all of that while I was watching it last night in preparation for this. I thought, boy, this is just, I gasped at times.
Well, the other key piece of it was the way that the film was originally written was that it would go basically the way the final film went, where they'd go down to, they called it the God Planet. That was the name in the script. But they went down to the God Planet and God would reveal himself. And originally there was this elaborate effect. So they had this beam of light that was kind of done on, I mean, it's all a little complicated, but done with reflective projection material and things like that. Mm-hmm. And the idea was they were going to create these images in the beam of light that would represent God. And that didn't work. So they ended up going into a soundstage and shooting an actor, actually a fairly well-known character actor named George Murdoch, dressed in the most cheesy God makeup you could ever come. I mean, literally looking like Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments. Like, it was the corniest interpretation, like, rather than something mysterious, they were so literal. And then when they did a screening of it, a lot of people were like really put off. And I heard some reports saying, well, people were offended, but I don't think they were necessarily offended by the interpretation of God as much as the cheesiness of the interpretation of God. So they ended up going back and shooting a bunch of other makeups to make it look like, you know, well, there's many different versions of God, and here's your idea of what he looks like, you know, based on, you know, Michelangelo paintings and things. So that was a big problem in that part. And then the second piece of it was, originally when they blow up the place where the creature is being kept, he was supposed to basically unleash all of these demons and spirits and sprites and who were going to chase Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and they would have to defeat them before, you know, before the final victory in the movie. And they did not have the effects for that. They didn't have the budget for that after all the other stuff didn't work. And then so they came up with this idea that instead of having these demons and spirits and visual effects come after them, kind of like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, that they'd have these creatures pull themselves out of the rock of the little temple area where they were, and they called them rock men. And they were going to have like 12 rock men kind of come after them. And that seemed like a reasonable compromise, except that they ended up building only one Rockman suit, and because it cost like $250,000, so 12 Rockmen would have been $3 million, would have been $6 million, and the budget for the film was $35 million, and they were not going to go over, so they couldn't do $6 million on some Rockman suits, so they decided they'd have one Rockman come after them, so they built a suit, and there's some test footage of the Rockman on one of the DVD releases or Blu-ray releases. And it's weird because it's a fairly good-looking design, but he was supposed to sort of light up and have smoke coming out of him and, you know, fire shooting out his eyes. And none of the effects, they were practical. None of them worked. So basically, the Rockman was a total dud. And it's funny, the design is pretty cool, but he looks like one of the Rock'em Sock'em robots. So it's kind of funny. So then they decided that at the last minute, they still needed something to chase them, so they literally took one of the images of the actor playing God and just sort of superimposed him in a couple places to look like this big giant head was chasing them, even though even that, as corny as it is, didn't come off. And they had like laser beams shooting out his eyes, and it was just all terribly cheesy, and none of it worked. So the ending was basically they lost the big spectacular ending that they needed for a movie like that to work, because I don't think the God thing was ever going to work, but if you had like good special effects and a big action finale, you probably could have saved it, but they had none of that.
Yeah, they also said in my research that I was reading that costume for the Rockman that you were talking about, they wanted it to breathe fire, but there was no way to do that without harming the stuntman inside. That was another problem they had. So, yeah.
Things you got to think about.
Oh, yeah. Practicalities, yeah. People. Yeah, that's all interesting. Well, there are a couple of bits of trivia here when we talk about the production that I thought was interesting. The principal photography began in the fall of 1988, around October. And yes. They started out in Los Angeles, and then there was the Teamsters went on strike. I don't know if you know about this, and if you do, I'll let you tell the story. I'm not going to...
I was working there at the time, and I remember because the Teamsters were like threatening to turn everybody's car over all the time when you drove in the morning. So it was a little crazy. But yeah, no, well, actually, their first the first shots were done. They went to Yosemite, and the film, or at least the human portions of the film, open in Yosemite, and they built a fake wall in the parking lot of Yosemite to line up with El Capitan, so it would look like Kirk was climbing up El Capitan, which I thought was a pretty nifty solution to that problem. But in order to get all of that stuff out there, they had a whole bunch of trucks that had to take all the stuff from Paramount in Hollywood out to Yosemite. And with the strike on, they ended up hiring scabs, which they don't really call them that, but I think they called them alternate transportation or something. And so then, you know, the tires were getting flattened, and I think one of them got set on fire or something. I mean, it was a lot of craziness going on, but eventually they got out there, and you know, anyone who's seen the film knows it sort of begins in the desert and ends in the desert. So basically all of that material was shot first. They were out there for a few weeks, and then they came back, and the rest was done on the stages at Paramount. And by the time they got back, the Teamster strike had been resolved. Oh, I should say the other piece of it, there was the famous writer's strike of 1988, happened while they were writing the script for the film. So it went from, they actually were on hold for that. That strike went on for, I can't remember. I participated in it, but it was like 7 months or something. It was really long. And so the production of the film was delayed by the writer's strike, and then they had problems because of the Teamsters. And but they did finally get out to Yosemite and did a lot of the shooting there, and then came back to Paramount, where they did like some of the effects of like when Kirk falls off El Capitan at the beginning, they cut from a real stuntman doing a decelerator drop off the actual El Capitan to the worst front rear projection screen work, where Spock actually catches up with Kirk and saves his life. And even when the film opened, it was like just appalling that they were letting stuff go out looking like that.
Yeah. And then that the set that replicated the forest floor was rotated 90 degrees, I believe, is what my understanding was.
Yeah, and if you watch the shot, because it's actually a pretty decent shot, where they grab Kirk, and he just before he hits the ground, and then the camera kind of turns on its side to show Spock holding him, supposedly with these rocket boots that Spock has. But you can see how, like, Leonard Nimoy puts on like 100 pounds because he's obviously wrapped in the harness, you know, around his costume. And he's at some very distressing angle that really makes no sense. A lot of the thing that happened with that film, there's a lot of sort of cheesy, bad sci-fi movie things in there. One of them is Spock has these rocket boots, and they shoot, like, the beginning of the movie is Kirk climbing El Capitan, although it cracks me up because the stunt guy they actually did get to do it is about 100 pounds lighter than Shatner. So, like, you see this really skinny guy crawling up the mountain, and then they reveal that it's Kirk. And literally in the opening night audience, I saw what people laughed because they just didn't match. And then so Spock has these rocket boots that play a part at several points in the movie, but they keep showing his feet with these, like, rocket, you know, jets, you know, jet stream shooting out the bottom. Those kind of things would only work against a surface. You know, you have to have surface, like, they're not anti-grav boots. So they keep showing these boots all through the movie. And the shot you're talking about where he's holding Kirk, the jets are shooting out the back of the boots. And, like, what are they pressing against? How are they holding him up? Like, it makes no sense whatsoever. And that kind of thing had been avoided in the other Star Trek films.
Oh, yeah.
And it was weird that they were sort of going with some, like, they also do a thing later in the film where when Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Cybok go down to the planet where God is supposed to be, everybody on the ship is watching everything that happens on the screen. And that's an old sci-fi movie cheesy trope. And, which makes no sense. Like, do these guys have cameras following them so you can see everything? And they just do it in a way like none of the Star Trek films had ever done stuff like that before. And it just added to sort of the tackiness of the whole thing.
Yeah. And they had the blue screen footage of Shatner falling that was composited while the stuntman set the record for the highest American descender fall. By plummeting off El Capitan,
the long shots were great. The composites were not great at all.
Not so much, exactly. Yeah.
The one thing they did do, like, they did a really smart thing because Shatner was a first-time director, and normally when you do that, you want to pair them with a really experienced cinematographer. They paired him with Andrew Laszlo, who was a quite experienced cinematographer.
Oh, yes.
And I do think, like, I think there are certain parts of the film that are very cheesy looking, but that has more to do with the effects and with some of the production design. But I think Laszlo actually does a really nice job of shooting the film, especially when they go to the God planet. He puts like a purple haze over everything. And I think he did some really nice work. So in some ways, the film looks way better than it has any right to.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, another thing that we were talking about the Teamsters, they said that one of the production's camera trucks actually exploded in the Paramount parking lot, and that after yes. that they were they actually headed to Yosemite in the middle of the night with a police escort. Yes. That's how they got there.
So, I think they were in U-Haul trucks or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, so, I remember seeing the aftermath of that. I didn't see that happen, but I did see the truck after. So yeah it was a little tough. You don't really want to mess around with the Teamsters too
nope.
much, but
yeah, message received.
Yes, yes.
Well, you know, true to Shatner's what we hear about Shatner, it sounds like he was definitely in character as he was directing the film, because they say that he cracked, quote unquote, during the filming in 110 degree Fahrenheit heat, and yes. he insulted the head electrician, and he ignored Andrew Laszlo's request for additional setup time.
Yes.
And then a driver failed to appear, and he stranded Shatner and a skeleton crew. A park ranger came to the rescue, and the production managed to film scenes of Cybok's followers before they lost daylight.
Yeah. Well, what Ralph Winter has talked about, and I think you see it in the film, Shatner obviously had never directed a film before. I think he had directed a couple of episodes of T.J. Hooker, but Shatner himself has said he got so fixated on the idea that he had to make the schedule that he started putting the schedule in front of everything else. And he just started pushing everybody. And Ralph Winter finally had to take him aside and say, listen, it's not your job to push everybody. Like, let the assistant directors do that. Let the producers do that. Your job is to direct when we're ready. And it took a few days for Shatner to kind of calm down, because he has a reputation as a guy who's very physical, very active. But I do know a couple of the people who worked on the film have said that they, and I actually agree with this, they said one of the problems with the movie, there's the problems of the story, and there's mm-hmm. the problem of the visual effects, and quite honestly, there's the problem of the humor. But if you watch the film, I think the other thing that is a significant issue with the movie is everybody's rushing their lines. Like, especially in the humor scenes, like they're playing the comedy, which you should never do. But like the scenes have, there's no life in any of them. Like, there's not like extras in the background or a sense that you're in a like a time and a place, you know, like they're all, you see characters in, like, there's a whole scene, a big fight scene in the shuttle bay of the Enterprise. And like, there's nothing going on in it other than the shots. There's no people in the background. There's no sense of machinery going on. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, it all looks like a couple of people. Even the sound effects are kind of minimal. And that's the kind of thing that happens when you're not taking the time to really set the scene. Like that to be blunt about it, that's television directing. From the
right.
70s and 80s, you know, I mean, now TV directing is a little different now, but like it looks like too much. It's staged like a television show. They get the key action down, but there's no like playing with it to give it some texture. There's clearly no improvising going on to get any reality into it. So it really feels to me like a movie that's directed by a second unit director, you know, and a second unit television director. And I know people who worked on the film, and they basically said Shatner just kept going, and he didn't stop to say, what can I do to make this scene really pop? What can I do to bring it to life? He just wanted to get everything in the can as quickly as he could. Now, that's a quality you want in a director up to a point, but you want them also to be directing, to be giving, you know, to creating some quality to it. And it just didn't happen on the picture. And you can see it in all of the scenes. Everything's very quick, very perfunctory. There's just not a lot of finesse to any of it.
Yeah, I even though I didn't hate it as much as I thought I would, I can certainly see its flaws. And I don't want to give the wrong impression that I thought it was a great film. Not a great film by any stretch of the imagination. It just wasn't quite as terrible as I thought it would be.
Right,
so, yeah,
right.
But I totally agree with everything you're saying there. And it does have a lot of the earmarks of a TV movie, as you mentioned. So that's kind of what it reminds you of. It was a good analogy. So a couple other things that are worth mentioning. I think Chekhov and Sulu. I'll get it out. Mm-hmm. Chekhov and Sulu. They didn't get a whole lot to do here, and I know Walter Koenig had said that he only worked on the film for 8 days. And then there was a scene that took place in front of Mount Rushmore that was actually cut, that they did actually film. So, they aren't in the film a whole lot, I will say that. And it's funny because I've actually heard, in an interview, I heard George Takei say that he wasn't going to do the film because he knew that with Shatner, they had a contentious relationship anyway. And when he heard Shatner was going to be directing the film, he said, I don't want to be a part of that. And so he bowed out, and he said that Shatner came to him personally, and he said in his voice, "Georgie, you know it's not going to be the same without..." That's my terrible Shatner impression. "Georgie, it's not going to be the same if you're not a part of the film. You know, you've got to do it." And he said, so he sweet talked me, and he said, I agreed against my better judgment. He goes, "It was as bad as I thought it would be. It was exactly what I expected him. He did exactly what I expected he would do." That's what he said.
See, it's funny because Koenig has a different story. Uh-huh. Like he said he was expecting that too. And he said that Shatner was actually great with him on the set.
Interesting.
There is a weird thing with Star Trek, I don't know, feuds, I guess.
Yes.
Famously, the supporting cast had issues with Shatner, but I also feel like I do feel a lot of those things got blown very out of proportion. Shatner's a difficult guy to work with. That is sort of his reputation.
Oh, yeah.
It's not to say that there isn't some truth to it. But if you look at a lot of what the complaints are, like Shatner was a leading man, and the thing that people forget over all the years of Star Trek is, if you look at the original series, there are three stars of that show, Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. The rest are day players, and they're day players who are not in every single episode, and people like them, and this is to take nothing away from them. They do very well when you see them, and they gave each of them a bit of a character. They obviously had Koenig, his Russian-ness. And Nichelle was, beautiful, and they were always giving her opportunities to sing because she began her career as a singer. So, they gave everybody moments, but these were basically, I think Jimmy Doohan, who played Scotty, was the only one on a contract. And his contract was, they were not for every episode. They were, basically 6 out of 12 or something like that. And the reason I'm getting at is a lot of the complaints some of the supporting actors have is, well, Shatner took over the dialogue, or Shatner wasn't very friendly with us, or Shatner, wanted the camera on him a lot. And my thought is, I get why they didn't care for that. But that seemed to me to be pretty standard behavior in television. And I don't think Shatner was doing anything any other star of any other series would have done. Nobody was going to give camera time to a day player, mm-hmm. unless there was a key story point or whatever. And so some of that resentment seems to me to be people not quite getting how things work. And I understand he was a little bit more difficult on some of the earlier films. But I do think, George Takei has created a sort of a myth of Shatner, Takei famously did not want to do Star Trek II, because he felt that his character didn't do much in it. And after he talked to Harve Bennett, they worked out this thing where there was this little scene where they were saying they were going to promote Sulu to captain of another ship.
Yeah.
And that he was only coming along on the adventure Star Trek II until he got his captaincy. And Takei really liked that because he had this idea that he wanted to be a captain. And the Shatner's point, which I agree with, he said that what he could never figure out is if Takei got promoted to captain, he wouldn't be on the show anymore because he'd be on his own ship and he wouldn't be on their ship anymore. So he but whatever. But anyway, that little bit got cut out of Star Trek II. And for years, Takei said Shatner had them cut it out. And the thing is, Shatner had no control like that over that. That was a decision Nicholas Meyer made as mm-hmm. as the director. So, like, Takei has this kind of hatred of Shatner that's not necessarily built. I mean, there probably were some things, but it seems a little blown out of proportion. Let me put it that way.
That's what I was going to say, overblown. Yeah. Sounds correct. Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess we would be remiss if we didn't mention the dance that Nichelle Nichols does in the film.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
well,
a strange again, scene, right?
misplaced comedy, right?
Yes, and, there you
and
go.
Supposedly the way that came about is they were saying, well, how are we going to distract the, because they had to steal these horses to ride into the village with. And they were like, how are we going to solve this problem? And one of them said, as a joke, I think it was David Lowry said, why don't we have Nichelle, you know, dance naked and distract the guys? Like, that was a joke. Like, that's a terrible idea. And I don't know who decided it was a good idea, but somebody decided it was a good idea. And the thing with Nichelle was she always loved an opportunity to sing or dance, so she didn't turn it down. But my thought is, oh, man, how undignified was that? Yeah. You know, it's like, it's a terrible joke. I actually felt terrible for her when I saw it, and I still feel, I rewatched it last night in preparation for this, and I felt terrible again. But that was the thing. There was all of this attempt to put these jokes in, but you know, Star Trek IV has a lot of humor in it, but the humor comes out of the situation or it comes out of the character. In Star Trek V, it's all imposed on the characters and imposed on the situations. And it's just painful. And the most obvious one was Scotty saying, I know this ship by the back of my hand. And as he says it, knocks himself out on the bulkhead. Yeah. And what makes that even worse is it's a terrible joke.
It is.
And totally out of place. And then they make a plot point out of it. Like, he's literally taken to sick bay and all this stuff, like, and you're like, oh my God, you're gonna keep playing this, like, you're not gonna just do it one off and then forget it, you're gonna keep going with this. And it's squinge inducing, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think Shatner may have been, I don't know that he was the only one at fault for okaying this idea, but he did say, and this is a quote on one of the commentaries, I think, he said, Nichelle has great gams, so anybody would stop and take a look, and that's all we needed. So it sounds like he did not necessarily veto that idea. So.
No. I think they all, at some point, decided it was a good idea. And I know she wanted to do it because, you know, it gave her a moment. To me, it's just not a dignified moment. But, you know, it's I don't know. And the whole movie is full of stuff like the joke for Sulu and Chekhov, you know, they're the pilot and the navigator, and the joke is they're hiking and they got lost. It's like, okay, all right. You know, and yes, there was a shot where they get lost hiking in a park, a national park, and there was a shot was left out where as they walk away, you see Mount Rushmore in the background, mm-hmm. but it has five heads on it. There's the regular four presidents, you know, and then a female African-American president.
Yeah.
So the idea being another head got added. The thing about it is that the matte painting was so bad that, like, this shot. I mean, what's interesting to me is in a film like that, how do you say a special effect shot is bad? Because what are you comparing it to? You know, you're comparing it to a whole bunch of other bad shots, but for whatever reason, they decided to cut that out. But, you know, the thing is, I don't want to, like, totally slam the film because I do think there are some good things in it. I do think Andy Laszlo's cinematography is really good.
Oh, very good, yes.
I also think the guest star is great. I think Lawrence Luckinbill is wonderful in the part of Cybok.
Mm-hmm.
He plays the tortured soul, and he has a lot of energy. He's not an actor that people thought of as the lead in movies. He'd done a lot of stage work, and he'd done the Boys in the Band. He'd done the stage production and the movie. But by the mid-'80s, he was mostly a television actor. And he'd done some stage stuff, but he wasn't really doing Broadway and everything anymore. And so he was kind of an out of left field choice because he wasn't really a movie name. But I thought he did wonderful in it. I think he really took the part by the horns and played the hell out of it. And I think he gets the best moments in the movie. There's a great moment when they finally arrive at the God planet, and he has this vision and he's expecting that they're going to go to this certain spot and God's going to greet them, and they get there and there's nothing. And you can see the heartbreak in his face. And to give the rest of them credit and Shatner credit too, then they play the reactions of the other characters who feel genuinely bad for him.
Yeah.
And I actually think it's a really good moment in the movie. And then, you know, when the creature reveals itself, and then they all realize it's not God, that it's a creature, and they've got to do something. He really steps up, and he gives the ending some great dynamism, which I think really works well. So and my understanding is it was Shatner's idea to cast him, because originally they wanted Sean Connery to play the part,
mm-hmm.
and Sean Connery was having that great career resurgence he had after The Untouchables. And they said that he declined because he'd already signed to do Indiana Jones, which I do not doubt, but I also don't think Sean Connery would have done a Star Trek movie at that point in his career. And a little piece of trivia, the planet, the God planet's name is Shakari. And it's named Shakari because it's named after Sean Connery, because that's what they were, I guess, hoping to entice him with that name of the planet. So,
yeah, that's that would have been interesting to have Connery in the film, though. That would,
yeah,
it makes you wonder.
Would have kicked it up a notch, maybe.
Maybe.
But they have, like, it's also a weird film because it totally wastes its supporting cast. They have David Warner in the film.
Yeah,
you know, and he literally has, if he has five scenes, that's probably overestimating, and part of it is there was more to the part, and a lot of it got cut out, but a lot of it got cut out because the scenes were not good, and Cynthia Gao, who plays the Romulan ambassador, she was dubbed because she was at that point a model, and I guess they weren't crazy about her vocal performance, so I don't know who did the dubbing, but it's not Cynthia Gao. So, like, there was just, you know, again, all of these not quite top-notch things happening. That said, I like the other thing, and a kudos that I want to give to Shatner, I don't think overall the film is particularly well directed, but there is the sequence that takes place in the lounge where Cybok is trying to convert Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and he does that by showing them their painful moments in their lives. And I think they did a really interesting thing there. They used a lot of theatrical technique. They have the characters standing against walls that are really scrims, and then when they turn the lights up, you know, suddenly you're looking into another reality. It's an old theatrical technique, but they made it work on film really well. And the way that sequence moves in and out of reality, I think is really good. I think Shatner really did a nice job with that. How much of that was him? How much of that was Andy Laszlo? I don't know. But they signed, you know, Shatner signed off on it. And I think it's a really nifty piece of directing. It's probably the best directed scene in the movie. That, and I do think Cybok's ending is quite good. I think Shatner really stepped up with that scene. So I don't want to totally slam it, you know. It also we should mention, I guess, it has a score by Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yeah.
Yeah, returning to the movies, like he had done the first Star Trek picture, and he had let them use the theme for the Next Generation. He didn't actually do that for the Next Generation, but he came back and did the score, and the score I think is quite good.
It adds
kind of a nice air of mystery and mysticism to the movie, so mm-hmm. that's one of its assets for sure.
I do have to mention this too, that this is something in my research that I found out, and I did kind of notice this too when I was watching it, that a mistake was left in the film. You were talking about it just kind of slapdash and leaving stuff in there that should have been excised, and there's a really big gaffe there when they zoom up the turbo shaft together. Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, they're on the run from Cybok's followers, and they go, I think they pass deck 52 twice.
Yeah,
and then they go all the way to deck 78.
Mm-hmm.
But Star Trek, if you're a fan of the show, if you know anything about it, it tells us that the ship only has 23 decks.
Right.
And then the lowest number is traditionally the highest deck. So the bridge atop the saucer section is deck 1. So they would have been going from the lowest deck, the highest deck, upward to the lowest deck.
Yes.
So it's all...
Yes.
It's kind of when you think about that, it's like, what?
Well, you were framing it as a mistake was left in. I sort of fear that I don't think the mistake was noticed.
That's probably true.
I think that was probably more of the problem. But yes, there's actually there's a famous Star Trek adjacent podcast called Inglorious Trekspirits.
Yes.
And they have started doing a new podcast about what they call Trek adjacent things, and they've called it Deck 78 exactly for that
That's
reason.
Good.
Yeah, so it's
now I get it.
Yeah, it's the mystery deck. Why is that deck there?
Oh,
yeah, and that's another sequence where they're climbing up and they need to get up higher. So Spock decides to go get his rocket boots, except he leaves from the bottom of the air shaft. And the whole idea is they can't go up because the whole ship is taken over by this alien army. Yet somehow he gets the boots, goes all the way up because he enters the scene by lowering himself down. So the whole premise is they can't use the decks because the ship is occupied, yet somehow he manages to sneak past everybody, get his little rocket boots, go all the way up to the top, and then drop down to save them. And it's sort of like, the logic is it's amateurish. And I think that's what it was the most shocking, because the Star Trek films, after the first movie, they were done on limited budgets. And there were, some of them are better than others. But they were smart for the most part. Like they made the most of what they have, and they didn't resort to a lot of this sort of cliched, I call it bad science fiction television stuff. And Star Trek V is full of it. And I don't know why, because Harv Bennett was the producer. Ralph Winter was also, they had produced the other ones. Like they knew that. And I don't know whether that was Shatner. I'm not really sure why it's so slapdash, but that's actually a good word for it. The movie has a slapdash feel to it.
Yes, it does. That's a good way to sum it all up.
Yeah.
Well, it's been interesting.
Still watchable, though. And as you said, I would watch that before I'd watch any of the JJ ones again. Okay. And honestly, I like it better than I like any of the next gen movies either. So
yeah, I would agree. Yeah, I've seen all those and I feel the same way. Yeah, the JJ Abrams films just immediately, within 15-20 minutes when they established that Kirk was angry at his father and there was that whole backstory, I thought, oh, this is where we're going. Okay.
Well, we're following Save the Cat, the screenwriting book. Like there isn't one moment that doesn't come out of the formula. So.
Yep. You're right. Yeah. You're right. And so that movie was, I'll get on my high horse while we're finishing up here. I will say that I was just could not, flabbergasted at how the positive response to that film. It was terrible. It was almost to the point where I was with a girl that I was dating at the time, and if she hadn't been with me, I certainly would have gotten up during the last half hour of the film. It was that insufferable to me. And I was just like, I can't believe the positive response to this film. It is bad. Bad, really bad. So,
well, whatever else it is, and I realize this statement is going to be a little arrogant, but the problem is it's not Star Trek.
That's it.
I don't know what it is, but it's not Star Trek.
Nope. All of the philosophical underpinnings that we all know and love that make Star Trek what it is. They've all been completely taken out of that film, and it's just a generic action film without any of the philosophical things that we embrace from Star Trek. And that, to me, is what is wrong with it in a nutshell.
We should probably do an episode on it sometime.
Oh, absolutely.
It won't be much of a positive episode, but I feel like the original series movies, you know, again, not all of them are great. They have their flaws, but all of them are smart. And
yes.
And even Star Trek V, like I think there's too much dumb stuff in it. I think lazy is the other thing. There's a lot of laziness in that film. Yet it was trying to do something. Like I don't think you can really successfully do a story about someone searching for God and actually finding them. Like
right.
You can do a story about searching for God. I think Harb Bennett was correct. I don't think the story mm-hmm. idea was ever going to work. But it's not run-of-the-mill story material. Like it was trying to do something,
yeah.
And as I said, like there's actually some thoughtfulness in some of the scenes with Cybok that I'm not going to knock, you know. And like I said, that scene where he suddenly realizes that he's probably been a fool was unexpected, and I thought pretty touching for what it was. That puts it ahead of a lot of, you know, lunkheaded action stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a genuine moment. And, that was good. And we can forgive them for the marshmallows. We didn't even talk about those.
Yes. They actually put out they did a promotional gimmick with that. They had a marshmallow dispenser, apparently.
Yeah.
So
I bet you can still find those on eBay.
Well, you can find everything on eBay. So
that's
sure.
Right. That's right. Yeah. There was another example of that fine humor that was,
yeah, what was kind of interesting is when they came back for Star Trek VI, which we'll talk about in a couple of years, they wiped all that away and they just went back and made a Star Trek film again. They didn't try to make it funny, and they didn't try it like. And I don't blame Shatner because I know there was a lot of pressure. I might blame him for the quality of the humor, you know, but he's not alone in that, because I think Harb Bennett and David Lowery share some of that. I know Nimoy was not particularly happy with a lot of the humor, although he gets some good moments in there. And the other thing is the original piece of the story that we talked about with Spock and McCoy sort of turning against Kirk and joining up with Cybok. Both of those actors absolutely refused to do that. So the script was rewritten. They said basically they would never turn against Kirk. Like that would be an imposed character turn that they both refused to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like one moment where McCoy looks like he might go along with Cybok and then changes his mind. And that's as much as that idea ever got developed.
Yeah, I think that would have definitely been out of character. I have to agree with him, I believe. So
Yeah.
And so, you know, the film ends with a scene around the campfire. And as we wrap up this episode, we'll talk about that. That was one of the last scenes that was filmed. And it's kind of a wraparound scene. There's an earlier, they're around the campfire earlier in the film. And then they wrap up going back to that. It's kind of a reference to that earlier scene. But this was it's supposed to look like it was spent around a campfire, I guess, in Yosemite where they were at earlier, but it was actually on a set on the Paramount lot, and there wasn't time to put tops on the trees, so Shatner had to keep the shots tighter than he would have liked so that nobody would notice there are no tops on those trees. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, they did a nice pullback in the end where they situated it in a very nice matte painting.
Yeah.
So that was how they solved that problem.
And it did work, yeah. Well, thanks again something, I think, there. Go on. I'm interrupting you.
No, I'm sorry. I just want to mention two more things and then
we'll
finish.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
The first was the advertising campaign. which famously had a teaser poster that came out about 3 months before the movie, and it was a shot of a starfield with a theater seat in it, and like floating in space, like from a movie theater seat, and the seat had a seatbelt on it. And the poster said, you're going to need seatbelts, like seatbelts in the theater this summer. The idea being that this movie is so exciting and such a roller coaster ride that you're going to need to buckle yourself in. But of course, as soon as the poster came out, by then word had spread, you know, and basically said that you needed the seatbelts to keep the audience from running out of the theater. So that kind of backfired on them. And we should mention that when it came out, it got one good review. It got a good review in the Los Angeles Times for some reason. It got very bad reviews, and it was the lowest grossing of the original Star Trek films. I think it finally topped out at about $55 million, which was quite about half of what Star Trek IV had done. And if you do interview or if you read interviews with Harv Bennett and Shatner, a lot of them, they will talk about, they felt that the Star Trek audience, by then the Next Generation was on, and they felt, well, the Star Trek audience just wasn't that excited about going to see a Star Trek movie because they could watch it at home. I will let them have that fantasy, but the fact is the movie wasn't good and people knew it, and that's why it didn't do very well.
Yeah. Yeah, because Star Trek VI did fairly well for its budget, I actually saw Star Trek VI in a theater. Like I said, we can talk about that on a future episode. But and it's actually a surprise that they actually made a sixth one. But that's a story we can tell at a different time.
there is a whole story to that, and we will save it for when we talk about that.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for coming on to talk about Star Trek V. We always enjoy your episodes where we dissect the Star Trek films. There are always so many interesting stories behind the creation of them.
Sure. Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me back. I really appreciate it.